Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the sodium doublet lines. So a sodium lamp will produce a characteristic yellow colour. Now, the older people amongst us will remember sodium lamps that were in the streets. These are the characteristic yellow street lamps, producing pretty much monochromatic yellow light. Monochromatic means, as far as the eye is concerned, it's only one colour. Now, these would start off with in the evening with a white glow as the mercury goes in the lamp, would heat up. And this would eventually heat the sodium, and it would be a sodium vapor lamp. And the beauty of a sodium vapor lamp is that it's got no element. It's actually this current going through sodium gas. So these were used for street lighting. And being a monochromatic lamp, it was far more efficient than an incandescent lamp. An incandescent lamp produces a lot of energy in ultraviolet and in the heat. But the sodium line is what's called a resonant line. It's a yellow line, and so the yellow is related to the energy difference between it. So I'm just trying to think 1 eV is 1024 nanometers, 2 eV is 12,040. I think that would be closer to it. 12,040 nanometers, and so it would be 620 nanometers yellow, which is before green, probably around 50 is green, so it'd be somewhere. Somewhere in that region. I'm just trying to think of the number of nanometers off the top of my head. This is to get your view of it. But that's the energy difference between two energy levels in sodium. So before we're going to understand that, there's a sodium atom described by the Bohr model. And you'd have a electron in a inner shell. First shell, second shell, third shell. It's a little bit difficult for school people in the diagrams with the shell diagrams to show electrons moving up to the fourth shell and stuff like that. So if we just go through the elements, it's hydrogen, helium, which is S shell, lithium, beryllium, which is S shell, 2S. Boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon, which is the 2P shell, so it's 2S, 2P. Then you get the third shell, which is sodium, magnesium, and then it goes up to aluminium, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, argon. I don't know whether I said argon in the last one. I said it should have been neon previously. And so sodium is got the full inner 1s electrons. It's got the 2s electrons. It's got the full 2p3 shell. And it's got one shell 3 electron. And that shell 3 electron goes up to the P state. The P state are notionally degenerate. So all orbitals of the P state, a thing on that ring, should have pretty much the same energy. And they do and they don't. It depends on what state this goes up to. It's the orbital coupling between the state. Because the state itself will have a magnetic field due to the electron notionally motion, but the electron actually doesn't move in its orbital. It actually the orbital stays the same, the orbital doesn't move, but the actual electron phase in the electron moves around the outside, and whether that motion corresponds to a magnetic field. So it's not a current. You can't actually dip a wire in one part of the electron and dip a wire in the other part of the electron and measure a current. You can't put an ammeter in there to watch what's going on. So it's current, but not a distance in our universe current. So there's not so much of an electron traveling so fast around it. So it's something called orbital angular momentum. And the orbital angular momentum of these states means that there's effectively rotating charge. Rotating charge means a magnetic field. And so you get a shape orbital angular momentum. You don't get a shape orbital angular momentum from the S state. The S state has got zero orbital angular momentum. And what it means is that the momentum of the entire electron is continually flowing inwards. Now you get the angular momentum by I dp dx, and if you look at this any electron density for a P shape, it's completely circular, so it's traveling inwards, and traveling radially inwards doesn't generate an external magnetic field, but you do get external magnetic field due to the motion of the electron. And you get another motion of the electron. When I say motion, it is a notional motion, not spin. So the electron itself doesn't spin, but it has a property of angular momentum with it, which we call spin. So it's actually, if the electron was actually physically spinning, depending on how you calculate it, it would be spinning. The exterior of it would be spinning faster than the speed of light. And that was a bit of a showstopper, and people realized what happened is two things happened. One is that the teachers said, don't worry, we'll keep on teaching. And the scientists said, put down our pen, it's time to do some calculations. And they worked out this thing called spin. Spin is a fundamental property of an electron to come through. So you've got the spin of the electron, which is the electron has its own magnetic field, a own moment, and the shape of the electron has a magnetic field, can have a magnetic field, and thing is that you can have, if you can imagine two magnets, you can, if the magnets are put south to north, they stick together. They lower in energy. It's a lower energy way to do it. Or if the magnets point oppositely, that is north to north or south to south, and you want to get them together in one electron, there's a certain amount of energy to push it. So you can get aligned and non-aligned. So you can have the intrinsic electric field, which is the spin, and the shape shape angular momentum, which is the orbital angular momentum. So you can have a spin field and orbital field, and these two things gives you two alternatives that you can have. So the one state is together. So at the S state, it's just the electron just has a single energy level. It doesn't matter whether the field is against or which way the field is pointing. Now, the thing I have to point to, there's a little few things I'll point out to you. But so the bottom 3S state is a single line, a single energy level with no magnetic field. The upper state has two configurations. One is that it can have its spin pointing with the field, or pointing against the electric field. There's a bug on me. And so this causes a splitting. And so this transition is called a resonant transition. That is there's nothing else is in the periodic table. There's no other states The P state goes to the S state. There's no alternatives up there. So whatever happens, in all the energy comes down, funnels down to the P state, and then to get to the P state, it's got to go to the S state. It's sort of like all the tributaries of a river going into the main river. It's the main stream. It's a resonant. It's also resonant in that is the ground state, which goes up to the first excited state. And the first excited state, when it goes down to the ground state, it produces some light which can be absorbed by the ground state. So it's resonantly absorbed and emitted. So your sodium light is held in there. So if you flash a sodium light, it will take a little while for the radiation to leak out of it. It's resonant. So resonant means it's a very powerful thing. And so a sodium lamp is a very efficient lamp. That was our answer to a laser before we could produce a single light. Now, one of the things that you say is that sodium, it's spontaneous emission. It's not laser emission. It's not come together. Now, this is one of the things is that if I have my sodium lamp right up against the slit, different parts of my lamp are glowing at different phases. It'll be incoherent. But I've got to pull my light far enough back from the slit, and therefore the slit samples the entire lamp. Each point of the slit samples the entire lamp. So essentially, if I have a single sodium lamp seen a long distance away, it's not going to produce interference pattern. But I have to put a slit in it, and the slit selects for the coherence. This is something that you have to pick up. Or I could reduce the effectiveness of a slit by having the lamp right up against a slit, and it would be different parts of the wave coming from different sides of the slit would be incoherent. In essence, the light from the slit has to diffract backwards. You know, your diffraction pattern, you have to be able to hold an entire mirror and have the light coming into your slit, and it will refract from the slit and go backwards. So you have to be able to able to do that. So this configuration where you have spin aligned and spin anti-aligned between the spin orbital angular momentum and the orbital angular momentum is the same. Now there's the one is got the total angular momentum of 1 minus 1/2, so it's the J S plus L equals J. The J is 1/2, or it's plus 1/2. Now here we're coming in for a few surprises, and this is one of the things that people learn. Oh, they learn from the selection rules, and then they look at the diagram, and very rarely do they point out the fact that the selection rules for this are so you can have different composite angular momentum. So you can have a composite total angular momentum J equals 1/2, or J equals 2/3. Now, when it says equals 2/3, that says that my quantum mechanical counting is 2/3, and my quantum mechanical counting is 1/2. That's its quantum number, its position number. Now, it just so happens that the position number or tag doesn't actually reflect the actual length of your composite vector, because your vector is not simply J squared, it's J is the square root of J into J plus 1. And that means that your spin, your total angular momentum, doesn't increase by the actual magnitude of it, doesn't increase by quantized whole number. In fact, it is a irrational number. The length of a spin is an irrational number. So for J equals 1/2, the actual length, and this is for spin as well, the actual length of the vector is J into J plus 1, which is the square root of j into j plus 1, which is the square root of... let's try and work this one out. The square root of 3 on 4, which is 0.866. Is that your classic... it's related to the cos of 60 degrees. But the story is that the length of this vector... your spin vector, your J vector or spin vector, if you just forget the orbital angular measure, but the J vector is greater than half. And it has to be because its projection onto the Z axis is a half. So the J two-thirds, say it's J a half, for instance, J a half has got a length of H 0.8660, I've forgotten what it is roughly there, and it has a projection of exactly half H, I think. So the JZ is as half H or minus half H. And so it's got to be, to have a projection which is non-zero, or is sensible, I suppose you could... it's your projection coming across. Is there, I've just got to think about is there another way? Look, the thing is that it's the dog, the tail wagging the dog. That's the length of the vector, and that's how it can have those projections. So your bottom state of your doublet splits, because that's equal to a J half, and can have H, can have a line H. Let me see. It can have a line of the difference of spacing between the it has two Zeeman lines or two lines within it, but it can have a projection onto the magnetic field axis of H a half or minus H a half. The top one, the length of that is, let's work this out, it's spin plus J is two-thirds, J is, 3 on 2, so it's 3 on 2 into 5 on 2. There you go. So that's 15 on 4 square. It's a bit under 2. Look, I think it's 1.9. The actual length of your J vector is not... The actual physical magnitude is different. That length, therefore, has, as you rotate, has projections of plus 3 on 2, plus a half, minus a half, minus 3 on 2. So it breaks up into four lines. Now, these lines are degenerate again, unless you add in a magnetic field, which says the magnetic field then shifts those lines equal to your energy. So the moment and the moment of moment are measured in joules per Tesla, and so you get those field lines coming up. And so if you have a sodium light lamp and you put it in a magnetic field, it will actually, those lines will begin to broaden. And in fact, those lines can tell you the magnetic field of your sodium lamp. So it's a sort of way that you could get the magnetic field with a magnetometer and send it down an optical fiber, or you could send me just a photograph of it and I'll be able to tell you your magnetic field. So you have your it's called a Zeeman effect, where you can actually spread and broaden those doublet lines. So the doublets are basically proof and thing of these two things called spin and orbital angular momentum. You can imagine people not quite fully trying to understand that where it happens, and then watching it broaden. And then seeing these lines come across. Now, what happens is that, in general, the angular momentum is coupled together. So if one is spinning, it spins in a uniform, in a unified way, as one unit. The rotation of that electron or that angular momentum is together because they're coupled together by the internal magnetic fields. So the fact that it's charged, it couples it together, and so this means that you have a coupled field where it breaks into four and two, but so you can actually break the coupling down. If the magnetic field is so strong, the fact that your local electron, it's the same electron, but it's got two same electrons, same point in space, so it integrates down to an infinitely small point in space. So in that same point in space, there are two mechanisms for magnetic field to be generated, even though nothing moves. So this is a bit of a hard thing to get your brain around. And so in a strong magnetic field, those two couple down, and I would expect that you'd have, you'd work it out by the splitting to be a spin component, like a doublet, and a J component. So I think it would go into the top one, it would go 3, and the bottom one, it would go 3. Top one used 4 and 2 as it comes out, because you get essentially you'd get a splitting due to the orientation of the electron, which is a double, and then you'd get a triplet above and triplet below, as you get a J equals 1 with a 1, 0, minus 1 thing. So you get 4 if you get 3 on 2, and 2, 3 if you get an integer 1, so 1, 0, minus 1. So it would go from 4 and 2 down to your full amount. And this means that you can, just with a sodium lamp and a coil, a strong magnetic field, get a real probe and hang on into the inside of an atom, and these mysterious things, this rotation or spin of an electron, and of course the orbits itself don't spin. You don't get a sodium atom and it collides and bounces in an unusual direction. Yeah, like if you know when you're bowling and you bowl a spinner, it hits the turf, it goes off to one side. So you would expect in a scattering experiment to see this, but it's not spinning like a cricket ball. There's no aspect for the J or the S to spin like this. So this is just an insight. Now it's taken me a little while to study that at university and get that out. Now, on top of that is some other spins. You have the nuclear spin there. And I've forgotten what the symbol is for it. Is it nuclear spin F? I don't know. You can add some more. So you've got fine splitting and hyperfine splitting. This is the nuclear effect. And I don't know whether to see. You can see, obviously, the hyperfine splitting will always easiest. It's just you've got to pull it apart, and by the time you pull it apart, it's decoupled to come across all these spin fields together. The beauty is that a simple lamp, a spectrometer, a magnetic field gives you an entree into physics, into quantum physics, and it's all the things that it tells you you can't imagine. That is so powerful. What you can't imagine is the actual electron is a spinning ball. You can't imagine that the actual orbital angular momentum is actually spinning in orbit. It's a complex number with a complex phase flushing throughout it. You can't imagine, even though you're told the spin is J equals 2/3, it doesn't mean the length of J is 2/3. The label for the, sort of like a t-shirt, extra large or small t-shirt written, worn by a big man, it stretches, the J is actually stretched in real life. Now, that contains a whole lot of tricks for young players. The amazing thing is that textbook after YouTube video, things that I look at, you go a certain time and it's sort of like they're almost like driving to a lost city, you know, trying to drive you to a lost city, and they miss the turn off. It's sort of, there are a few secret places in the Blue Mountains where there's a track and you're walking along the track and you have to pick the turn off at exactly the right place to go into this lost world of these beautiful waterfalls, hidden waterfalls and things like this. And you have to know to pick off, and basically you have to pace your way from a corner to work out where to go, and often you miss it, and it takes a little while to pick what's going on. Very similar to this, you read, you listen to these, and these people are taking you on a tour, and they miss the turn off, and then you say, how's this going to end? And it ends dreadfully, they say. And as we know from the textbooks, and there's no deeper explanation. So I hope you've enjoyed listening to that. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.